Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. It's Friday, and we've got some interesting stuff lined up for you. Berlin history, a tutorial on how to make great pies, national correspondent Bob Ney. Then we'll hear about Manon Belzile, known as the Motor Ninja, and we'll finish up hearing about this week's Tech Jam. But first, okay, by now I think you know that if you call, write, or even make eye contact with me, you are going to wind up on this show as a guest. It's a fact of how I run this program. So earlier this week, when Charlotte Strasser was on the show and needed help identifying mystery audio cuts that she has found in the WDEV Vault of Sound, several listeners jumped in to help, none more enthusiastically than Corinne Cooper, president of the Berlin Historical Society. So guess who our first guest is today? Corinne Cooper, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick, thanks so much for asking me to come on.
Oh, it's our pleasure. We want to thank you for all your help this week. Listeners, to ask Corinne a question about the history of Berlin or to share a fact about it, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I have to ask, Corinne, is it Berlin or Berlin?
You know, people say that, and some people do prefer it to be not as it is pronounced in Germany. But my whole thing is, as long as people know where Berlin is and, you know, and that they're in Berlin, we've never had a good identity in that so many people think parts of Berlin are actually part of Montpelier or part of Barry. And it happens all the time. People don't realize Montpelier Junction, the train station there, that's Berlin.
Wait, what?
Montpelier Junction is Berlin.
Really?
They all think it's part of Montpelier, but it's not.
It's
Berlin going all the way down to past the 3 Mile Bridge. When you get to the turn for Jonesbrook Road, that's where it changes to Moortown. But the only part of Montpelier on the Junction Road is when you're first turning onto Junction Road, there's that little house that Middlesex Electric uses. Mm-hmm. That's Montpelier. But when you pass over that little bridge and there's the big farmhouse and Capital Steel and all that's Berlin.
How about that? Montpelier Junction is in Berlin, not in Montpelier. How about that?
It is. And part of the problem with the identity, too, is way back when, the border between Montpelier and Berlin was the Winooski River.
Mm-hmm.
And a piece of Berlin was annexed off to Montpelier. It was finalized in February of 1899. And so where National Life is, where the Montpelier High School is, all along Berlin Street, all that was Berlin.
Wow.
But there were a lot of Montpelier residents who had businesses over on the Berlin side, and Berlin saw how Montpelier was getting sidewalks and electricity, and they just identified more with Montpelier being right across the river there.
Yeah.
So that doesn't help as far as the identity, and we don't have our own zip code that we use. We used to have one. Down in Riverton was the oldest one that we had. Back when we had postmasters up in Berlin Corner, there weren't zip codes, but it was decided that when the postal lady down in Riverton, I believe it was when she died, they decided instead of replacing her, the Postal Service decided we didn't need to have our own post office. But anyway, so we use either Northfield's, Montpelier's, or Barry's, depending on what section of town you live in, and so that doesn't help with the identity either.
Oh, my. Well, Corinne, this is the morning we get some identity for Berlin or Berlin. So where did the name come from in the first place?
Well, there's some controversy. A lot of people think that it did come from Germany's Berlin, but then there are some people that think it came more directly from there's several other Berlins in the country,
mm-hmm.
and one of them is Berlin, Massachusetts, And the same time that Berlin, Vermont came about, Worcester also did, and there's both a Berlin and a Worcester, Massachusetts. And so there's some thought that maybe the names really just came from, you know, people who had come up north a little further and settled up here. So they're really not positive.
Yeah. I've got to admit, when I drive through the village of West Berlin, I always think I'm going to eventually come upon Checkpoint Charlie as I'm driving through there. But that's not the case.
You know, Riverton used to be the happening place. My great-grandfather and two of his brothers had a Davis Brothers Granite. Mm-hmm. And before that, it had been like a Berlin Granite place, but they bought the place. They had started their business in Northfield. They came up to Riverton. The reason being because, they could get water power and because the railroad went through there. But anyway, in the early 1900s, they employed over 200 people.
Wow.
You know, think about that. Riverton was a different place back then. It was really, really happening.
That was indeed.
And where there used to be a little mom and pop store in Riverton, right now the current owner is working on putting some life back into that building, as far as he'd like to have it be a, I can't think of the right name, but a food hub, I guess, where food is turned into, you know, your dinner that you can, you know, pick up and go with. And so I hope something like that does happen, because I think the pandemic has certainly shown us that local is good.
That's
and
right.
Staying close to home can be really good too.
Yeah, it is a mantra we know well here in Vermont, but really got the exclamation point when we saw some of the problems with the supply chain for food in the early days of the pandemic. I'm going to hop around in Berlin's history, but if you want to talk about something, I'm not going to stop you.
Well,
but
I want to go back to what we were saying about Montpelier Junction.
Go ahead.
I didn't know that was Berlin. And so I came across something that I have found fascinating, and that is back in 1895, there in the junction, which that was the main train station there. It was an offshoot in order to get all the way into Montpelier. Mm-hmm. Montpelier did have a train station across from the pavilion, and then people can still see the old Montpelier Wells one that's across from Shaw's.
Right.
But so Montpelier Junction was the main station. And so back in 1895, there was a huge performance there. Buffalo Bill's Wild West and the Congress of Rough Riders of the World came in. It wasn't their only stop. They also did shows in Rutland, Burlington, and up in St. Albans, but it was new to Vermont, and people turned out. First, let me describe it a little bit.
All right.
Where they said they had, let me see here. They had two trains, I believe, two trains for transportation, an army of men, 225 draft horses, and 300 other horses, an immense portable grandstand capable of seating 20,000 people, a portable electric light plant. It was a big production that came in. And tickets were on sale. If you were just coming just from Montpelier, the round trip would cost you 10 cents, but they had special trains as far as coming from Randolph and Braintree and East Granville, and those include the admission costs, and those prices range between like $1 and $1.50, depending where you were coming from. Mm-hmm. And they were selling licenses for refreshment booths you could get for $2 to set up your goods there. Anyway, they had two shows, one in the afternoon and one in the evening, both full shows. The one in the afternoon brought in 10,000 people, and the one in the evening, 5,000 people.
Wow.
Yeah, and this compares to down in Rutland, they brought in about 25,000 people, and to the Burlington show, more like 30,000 people. But just to think of there being between 5,000 and 10,000 people in Montpelier Junction for this big show just really, really made me go, wow. And, of course, although most people were simply having fun there and enjoying the show, I did note that in the articles that they said there was considerable drunkenness around the grounds and on the street, and sneak thieves who traveled with the show were numerous and did a thriving business. And in fact, there was one mention here where the Watchman and Journal said that Fred T. Kent thinks it's a little expensive to attend Buffalo Bill's Wild West show at the Junction, as just before the train left for the north, he was relieved of a diamond scarf pin valued at $150 and a roll of bills which he carried in his trousers pocket to the amount of $157.
Oh my.
So it wasn't a great day for everybody, but I think a lot of people had fun.
Oh, I agree. And it should be noted that Buffalo Bill's Wild West show was a big deal in the day, traveled all over the U.S., over to Europe. Jeez, I'm ready to give your number out, Corinne. I know you can answer most questions. Hey, tell us about something. This was like in the mid-40s, the Airborne Attack Show.
Yeah, up at the what was then called the Barry Montpelier Airport, and the airport started back in 1929. After the 1927 flood, they really saw that there was indeed a need. That's how mail and all was coming in after the flood. But so they found the site. It was really the people of Montpelier and Barrie that were really pushing to make it happen. Anyway, in 1940, and they had shows there on a regular basis. Because that was the rage back then, was to be able to see these planes and, you know, stunt people and all perform great stuff. But in 1945, they had the biggest event ever there. They are estimating between 20 and 25,000 people turn out to the airport. Wow. And it's kind of interesting, the description that they have as far as people coming in, where do I have it here, where they're talking about, it says, shortly afternoon, all roads leading to it were filled with a steady procession of automobiles. Hmm. Many walked from the two cities to the field. And
it was like the last Phish concert in Coventry.
Yeah, exactly. It was saying sometimes the people walking were making as fast progress as the slow-moving vehicles, because although there were no accidents, of course, some people ended up having mechanical problems or flat tires, and everybody was doing their best to get traffic through. And so they also talked about, you know, how every place was simply so crowded, you know, like there was 1,000 vehicles parked on the Woodbury Field there at the airport. Mm. And, you know, it was just hard to squish everybody in, but they did. And it was simply an exciting day. And I'll read you a little bit of the description.
Okay.
Where it says, one C-46 will come over the field with a stick of 12 paratroopers jumping, landing, picking up their equipment, and running toward the crowd. They will hit the dirt in a battle position as a double tow of CG-4A gliders cut loose overhead and land to make a smoke pot set up by the paratroopers. And then it goes on, as the CG-4As come in for their landing, a CG-13 glider will also cut loose on the field, and as the gliders land, tactical leads will be taken from them and formed in battle position behind the line of the paratroopers. And then it talks about a supply drop ship coming in and dropping supplies that will be retrieved by jeeps flown in by the gliders. And they had volunteers from the crowd being treated as patients and being loaded into an evacuation ship. They had all these planes and all open for people to be able to check them out. And of what the bigger picture was the effort to sell war bonds during that time. And so it talks about how people from all the different banks in the area were set up there to sell them, with the largest individual sales being $100 bonds, and those that purchased those $100 bonds, it would be from that group of people that one person would be awarded the dime that one of the gliders landed on after it had been cut loose by a plane. And the interesting thing about that dime is that I guess they always asked for an old dime just to, I don't know, just part of the production of doing this. Mm-hmm. And so when they asked for an old dime, a John M. Donahue of Montpelier had been carrying around this old dime as a pocket piece. It was dated 1834. And it says that it was one of the oldest dimes ever used for that purpose, and that he was an employee of Bell Aircraft up in Burlington.
Anyway,
it was just a huge deal. They had, you know, extra buses from Vermont Transit to get people there. I just can't even imagine what it was like to get out of there at the end of it.
Oh, wow. All right. We've got a couple of people on the line, Corinne. I want to get to them. Before we do, I do want to mention that Amelia Earhart did come to the state capitol Montpelier to talk to the legislature at one point to get these regional airports around Vermont. And so I just wanted to make that note.
Yeah, she actually flew in to the Barrie-Montpelier Airport. By the way, I didn't mention that it was in the late 60s that the state took over the airport and it became known as the Edward F. Knapp Airport. But Amelia Earhart flew in October 4th. She was scheduled to come in for 11 o'clock. But before that, she was supposed to come in to White River Junction, but they were fogged in.
Mm-hmm.
So she came up early, had breakfast with somebody there at the airport, flew back out to come in at 11 o'clock as scheduled. And that's something that I would love. Somebody must have a photo of Amelia Earhart at our Berlin airport. And wow, there's a lot of things we'd like photos of that we don't have.
Yeah.
But that, to me, would be incredible.
All right, let's get to some phone calls.
That Richard Turner wrote on our airport.
All right, Dale is up first from Montpelier. Hi, Dale, what's up?
Hey, sir, it's Barry, actually, but that's okay. Can you tell me, Corinne, anything about the Black Cemetery? When I was a kid, my dad took me up there hunting. I was probably 14. I'm 62 now.
Dale, once again, what was it you were asking about?
The Black Cemetery.
Oh, Black Cemetery.
About. Yeah, and this is the third person within the last month that has asked me about that.
Hmm.
The cemetery became one of Berlin cemeteries back in 1796. I believe the man's name was Isaac Black, where the property came from. And I've had several people wonder if the Black Cemetery was about where Black or African American people were buried. It is not. It's just the name of the family was the Black family.
Mm. All right. Let's take another call. Our Craig Durham is on the line. Craig, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick. Thank you. It's an honor to finally be on Vermont Viewpoint. And, you know, it took Corinne to get me to call, and Corinne and I talked Berlin. How you doing, Corinne? I've actually been into the Berlin Historical Society Museum in the Berlin town offices, and just want to recommend to anybody who is curious about sort of the history of this area to check that out, because you find some really neat stuff. And I know I've had a lot of time. I had a lot of time last year when I was knocked out of work because of the pandemic to look into the history of my really old house, which is now in Montpelier, used to be Berlin, and that sort of piqued my interest into this annexation that Corinne was talking about earlier in the program. So if you live on the Berlin side of the Winooski River, maybe look around your basement and see if you can't find old photos what it used to look like over here.
Wow.
Because it is a really neat part of Montpelier and a pretty interesting story about how it changed from Berlin to Montpelier.
I love it. Thanks so much for that call, Craig.
All right, Rick. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Go ahead, Corinne.
Craig knows. Anybody that comes in, they can just see my enthusiasm just bubble right over as far as when it comes to talking history. And we would love not only for people to come visit us. We're so lucky to have this space at the town offices. And we have some programs we didn't last year during the pandemic, but this has been quite a week for me between helping to solve some mysteries for you guys. We had a program last night on the Barrie-Montpelier Road, which was a lot of fun. So I'm just pumped up on history. But as I say, we would love more people to get involved, whether it's just, whether they're wanting to research some history, whether they have things to share with us. We would love people to help us out with some projects. There's both some research that can be done. There's just working with our files, getting stuff scanned so it can, get onto our computer and be backed up by Carbonite so we don't ever lose it, hopefully. And being able to go out and interview people. There's a lot of small historical societies in the area where all of them would love to have more people involved. I mean, there, I go to some of the other programs that, that are around, you know, in East Montpelier, where they share programs with Callis, and, down in Williamstown and Brookfield, and Waterbury has an active one. Montpelier, they are, getting their Montpelier Historical Society, charged back up, and I'm actually part of that effort. What's really exciting is, for as much as we would like people to come here, there's really a lot of exciting stuff going on online. One of the things that I absolutely love about Facebook, and I have mixed feelings about Facebook, but are the history pages that they have. And so I have a Berlin, Vermont Memories one, which isn't as active and exciting as the newer Montpelier history one that Dana Barber started earlier this year. And what's wonderful there, and there's ones in Barrie and in Burlington and down in Randolph, and what's wonderful is the crowdsourcing of information that goes on. Somebody might have some information to put up, and then you get others jumping in and bringing forward what they know, or they go do some research. And so whether it's old newspaper articles or clips of maps or just stories, and just pulling all this information together is just so exciting. And sometimes somebody simply has a question, and they're thrilled to get an answer, like you guys were thrilled to get an answer the other day.
Yeah, we really were. Corinne Cooper is the president of the Berlin Historical Society. She's also Berlin's assistant town clerk. And you can learn more about the history of the town of Berlin at berlinvt.org. Corinne, it's been quite a week for you. I want to thank you so very much.
Hope to talk to you again soon.
All right, you will. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we're going to get tips on how to make outstanding pies. And tonight at 6 o'clock, or I'm sorry, tonight on WDEV, it's Game 6 of the ALCS from Houston. Coverage of the Sox-Astros matchup begins at 7:08. Game time is 8:08. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table, and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest, and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping, and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. The apples have ripened. There's a chill in the air. This is the time for homes to be warmed by ovens, baking delicious pies, and filling the house with the amazing aromas that accompany those delicacies. Many recipes are handed down from one generation to the next, but there's always a way to improve your pie making. And we've got Gary Stewart to help us with our pie making game. He is the owner of the Pie Guy in Winooski, and he joins us now. Gary, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thank you, Rick. Good morning to you and to your listeners.
Good morning. Hey, let's get baking. Listeners, if you've got questions about pie baking, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Gary, from who did you learn to bake pies?
Wow. from my mom and from her mother. They never taught me, but I watched them, at least my mom. And just to let your viewers know, my husband and I, we are recent transplants here from Texas.
That's not a Vermont accent we hear?
No, probably not. But I've been told it's not much of a Texas accent either. I grew up in the urban areas of Houston.
All right.
But my mom is from West Texas, and her mom, Grandma Cray, her pies were just, and my mom's too, they were just works of art. We would go and visit my mom's side of the family in Breckenridge, Texas, West Texas, just east of Abilene. And she and her husband, my mom's dad, had a cafe, roadside cafe outside of Breckenridge. And he did the gabbing. She did the talking. And when I was a little kid, and then growing up into my teens, you know, the cafe wasn't open, but she would make these incredible pies for us when we would come. I mean, meringue pies, like caramel meringue pie, lemon meringue pie, coconut meringue pie, chocolate meringue pie. And they just looked like if God decided to come down in pie form, there they were.
Oh.
And I think what struck me, not just because how beautiful they look, her meringues were immaculate. They were just golden and glorious. And how wonderful they tasted. It was the love that struck me as a little kid, just how the love that she showed us. And I was pretty much a loner growing up, but I felt seen by her and appreciated by her. And for me, I guess pies became emblematic of her love for me. And my mom was a great cook and loved entertaining people, and her pies were glorious too. She never showed me. I would watch her at times, but I was inspired by it. And I've always had an interest in food and how it's associated with, you know, people caring about each other, people loving each other, and also just having a great time, you know, celebrating.
Well, Gary, before we talk about preparing a pie, what are the elements of the finished pie that we should be aiming to achieve?
Okay. Well, you want it to look beautiful, and you want it to taste good. And so, you know, for beginners, try to find a good pie cookbook. I mean, my first one that I bought was Martha Stewart's Original Pies and Tart cookbook, and it's like one of my Bibles, and shows beautiful pictures and very easy instructions. And so, before being, quote, creative, just follow the recipes and get to know your material. Also, really important about is the crust. If you got a good crust, you're halfway there. And so learning how to make a crust. And for me, and I think I got this from Martha Stewart, is that everything needs that you make your crust with, it needs to be cold. And in fact, I put my flour, my sugar, and for sure in the freezer. And even if a metal mixing bowl, if I use to make the crust, I put it in the freezer. Now, that's down in Texas because it can get hot, and you know, we didn't have central air, and so I had to, you know, had a window unit, so I had to make sure that my butter and shortening don't melt before they're worked in, because you want your shortening and your butter to have pockets, you know, throughout the flour when you're working it in, you know, cutting it in.
Right.
So it makes it for a flaky, a flaky crust. It makes for a flaky crust. And if it melts before you add water, then you're going to get a rubbery crust. And so the thing is to keep your ingredients cold.
Mm-hmm. And Gary, you're saying butter and shortening. You use both in making that crust?
Yes, right.
Wow.
Yeah. As a rule, sometimes a crust, like if you're making a sugary kind of tart, you would just have a simple butter crust. But if for, you know, a regular pie crust, I use butter and shortening because the butter gives it the flavor. The shortening gives it the chance of being flaky, flakier. And so it's a great combo. I've used a recipe for crust making from an incredible cookbook that I'm now trying to, Carol Walter's Great Pies and Tarts, another great book that I use. I want to give a kudos to those who have inspired me with their cooking.
Yeah.
But it's really, you know, quite simple. And anyone really can do it. And that's why I have also started, well, when I was back in Dallas, I would do pie parties where I, you know, folks would bring some friends over and I would, you know, tell them what kind of pies or tarts I make and which ones they would be interested. They select. And while they're noshing, I show them, okay, this is how you make this pie or this tart. And we do the crust. I oversee it. I show them, okay, this is what you need to get. And for me, I provide them the flour and all of that, you know, the ingredients, and I try to make it as organic as possible.
And are you doing that here? Are you being hired for pie parties here in Vermont now?
Well, I had one gig so far.
Wow.
And wanting to do that. It's a wonderful way of getting together. There was two young couples, and they wanted to learn how to make salted caramel apple pie, one of my specialties. Mm. And one wanted it regular crust. The other wanted non-gluten crust. Mm-hmm. And we did it, and they had cocktails, they had hors d'oeuvres, and they were having a great time, and their pies came out beautifully. And they enjoyed them. And so it's really fun. I've done it before back in Dallas, and people really like to know, you know, how do you make this? And when the product is finished, we eat it. We eat their creations.
Of course.
And say, here, you made it. You made
wow.
it. And they're just really tickled and pleased with it. And so I'm wanting to be able to do that on the side. You know, I'm working at Central Market,
mm-hmm.
The South End one here in the Burlington area. But also I'm open to baking for people for special events, the holidays.
Oh, yeah.
Because I love baking.
Oh, I love it.
This is a wonderful time of year to do it. So,
yeah. Let's go to the phones. We've got Mary calling from Randolph Center. Hi, Mary.
Hey, good morning, Rick.
Morning.
Good morning, Gary. Oh, I love
it. Good morning.
I love baking pies, and your pies sound extraordinary. Have you ever used vodka in your crust? I substitute vodka instead of the water in my crust.
Interesting.
Wow, I haven't done that personally. Because, you know, when I started, that wasn't known, or at least you know, not in the books that I've done, but I've had people tell me they swear by it, and I think that's great. You know, it's whatever works. There's so many different pie oral traditions. And, you know, if it works, it tastes good, looks good, go with it. I should try it. I have a little bar here at our home. I have some vodka. And instead of just making cocktails with it, I should try it once and see how it goes.
Yeah.
Well, Mary, can you explain, like, the difference between a crust that's made with vodka as opposed to water, how it comes out differently?
Yeah, it's a bit flakier because of obviously the alcohol evaporates during the baking process. So there's no alcohol in the pie.
Right.
And I also chill all of my ingredients too. That's
there
a great
go.
Secret, Gary. Yeah. But yeah, the pie is one.
I need to try that.
Yeah.
All right, Mary, thanks so much. Yeah.
Bye.
All right, there you go, Gary, when you're ready to try, you know, just a little something different, vodka instead of the water. All right, so we've
– that sounds great.
Isn't that fantastic? All right, now we've talked about the crust, but let's talk now about filling the pie. What is the key to making wonderful fillings?
Wow. Okay. Again, find a good cookbook.
Mm-hmm.
Find one with pictures. I'm very visual. And you get a sense of, okay, this is what it's supposed to look like. When I buy, you know, when I look at the calendar, it's like, okay, what are the ingredients that are available right now? I try to avoid buying frozen stuff. I mean, I've done it There's nothing wrong with it, but I kind of like to go by nature and see, okay, what's available. So when spring hits, oh, it's strawberry rhubarb. You know, I have a strawberry rhubarb pie that I make with orange and orange liqueur. It's great. And in the summer, it's blueberries, it's blackberries, it's peach, and, you know, just I try to get organic as much as possible and support local growers. It's easier here than it is, I think, for the most part, than Texas. You know, Texas does produce blueberries, surprisingly, but different kinds. But and then when it's the fall, well, you know, it's apples and pears, and, you know, so I kind of like that sense of when I bake, it's reflecting the season. And then, you know, when I season, I season to taste, you know. So the recipes may say something like only use this much spice or whatever. If I feel like, I need to kick it up a little bit, I'm willing to do it, you know, just to give it a little extra zing. And then I've always, over time, have found out, well, if I add a little bit of bourbon to the fruit or some alcohol, or like the lavender blueberry pie, I was down at a store in Dallas walking through the salad dressing section, and I saw a vinaigrette for lavender blueberry. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting. And then I thought, I love blueberries in desserts, and I've seen people use lavender flavor in some other kind of desserts. And so I put those two together, and I won a pie competition down in Dallas. So after a while, when people have, you know, been creating pies and tarts, then they can kind of let their imagination or, you know, get a little creative, adding something to it.
Yeah. Well, you also make a dark rum ginger pumpkin pie. And I've got to imagine, do neighbors start banging on your door when they smell that baking?
Well, sometimes, I have to say, when the wonderful reporter from 7 Days came.
Yeah, Melissa Passanen.
Article. Yeah, I mean, when she came back, she had some errands to do while the pie was baking, and when she came back, the house just smelled fabulous. And I, you know, growing up, I would smell that when my mother was baking or just cooking, you know.
Yeah.
That recipe for the extra ginger dark rum pumpkin pie comes from the Vegetarian Epicure, Book 2 by Anna Thomas, and I've been making that thing for over 30 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's just, you know, I like ginger, and it's, I don't think it's overly gingery, but what gives it a kick is that, besides the dark rum, which I love, is getting candied ginger root. And when you pre-bake your pie shell, you know, just enough so that the custard doesn't turn it into mush,
right,
you slice the candied ginger root thin on the bottom in the shell. And when you bake it with the custard, it melts pretty much, and it just gives it that little extra zing. And people love it.
Oh, Gary, you're killing us. Well, we've mentioned the baking parties that you do, but I understand you also have a class you'll be teaching coming up.
Yes, I was going to mention that. When I joined City Market, I told them, you know, I love to make pies and tarts and baking. And they said, well, listen, they do classes. And so next Wednesday, October the 27th, from 5:30 p.m. to 7 p.m., is going to be a virtual class on pies and tarts. People just need to go to City Market's website, and that's where they can find out. They have a calendar of events, and it's free. And, you know, this is my first time to do a live stream baking. I've Zoomed a lot because I've been an activist and organizer for 30-some-odd years. So I'm used to Zoom, but, I think it's going to be fun. We're going to do the, dark rum, extra ginger pumpkin pie. And then also I'm going to be doing a maple, coffee, chocolate, walnut pie. And so people have a choice which one they want to do. And so the walnut pie is really great. In fact, I like it more than pecan pie.
Yeah.
The truth. Even though I'm a quote, Southerner.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot
it's
of
almost sacrilege to say what you just said.
England.
Yeah.
That people can celebrate.
Now, we have about a minute left, but once a pie is done, how long should a pie rest or cool after it's removed from the oven?
Well, when it comes to fruit pies, an hour at least, probably a couple of hours.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sometimes at parties, people are like, I want it now. And what helps is just have some fresh vanilla ice cream
there you go.
On it. But, you know, for fruit pies, well, for pies, quite often you need to give it a couple of hours for the, like, the meringue pies, the filling to gel, you know, not be runny.
Oh, right.
And the same thing with fruit pies. So I know it's you want to jump at the chance, but, you know, better to kind of let them sit. You know, your mom and your grandmother knew
yeah.
you let the pies cool down before
absolutely.
You serve them.
Yeah. Well, if we've learned anything during this pandemic, it's patience. So just be a little patient.
Yes, and there's plenty of time for that. And also, I just want to let you know that yesterday I created my Facebook page.
Oh, excellent.
The Pie Guy. Yeah, so people can go to Facebook and look up The Pie Guy. And, you know, I'm still tweaking it, but it's there. And then people can also just email me. If I can share that,
please
it's all
do.
Small case, Gary Stewart, GarySTuard, 123@gmail.com. And, you know, if you want something for Halloween, you know, Thanksgiving is coming up, Christmas, I enjoy baking. I mean, I'm not a storefront. I'm at home.
Yep.
And, but I've done a lot of baking, and if you just don't have time but want something nice and sweet and homemade and organic, I'm your pie guy.
All right. Gary Stewart of Winooski is the pie guy. You can find him at The Pie Guy on Facebook. You can email Gary Stewart, 123@gmail.com. This was a delicious segment. Thanks so much, Gary. Take care.
Oh, thank you, and I should bring you a pie.
I'd love it. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. National correspondent Bob Ney joins us now. Let's get an update on what's happening in the rest of the country and around the world. Bob, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick.
Bob, let's start with the COVID numbers.
Right. Rick, last Friday there were 719,822 Americans who had died of COVID. This week there's 731,541, so about an 11,000 person difference. And in the world, there were about 4,877,000. Now there's 4,925,000. So we're kind of, and I gave those stats because we're kind of seeing some consistency on our numbers, and then also some statistical consistency on world numbers. You know, the bottom line now on the deaths in the United States, we did decrease, since you and I talked last week, 13.4% from the previous 7 days. We decreased hospitalizations 8.8% down, and vaccinations are still lagging a bit. I think, you know, about 65.6% of the populations received one dose, and of course it's 52% last week we spoke received two. Now it's 56.
Oh.
So those numbers are, you know, kind of agonizingly going up slow, although the booster seems to be catching wind.
Yeah, so People are starting to line up for either a second or third shot, depending on which ones they had. And it looks like we can do the mix and match thing with boosters. Tell us about that, Bob.
Right. Now, and this one, I don't know what to think. I'm not a scientist or claim to be or a doctor, but
right.
What they're saying is that with Pfizer, of course, they are saying 65 and over the shot, and then you have Moderna, then you have Johnson & Johnson, and they are saying, so far the CDC, et cetera, the FDA, that you can mix and match those. So I had Moderna myself, So I guess I can go get Pfizer. If I get Moderna again, it's a half dose of what I got, So I'm going to personally go get another Moderna.
Right. Now, the one that really seems to get a boost in this boosters is the J&J effectiveness, because with the one dose, I think the effectiveness was not quite as strong as
right.
the Pfizer and Moderna, which you got the double boost, the double shot. And if you had a J&J, you can get anything, right, as a booster, and it really does
right.
increase the effectiveness of the vaccine for you.
It takes you up to 94%
yeah,
protection that's against it.
Very yes. encouraging news.
You're right. It's very effective.
Yeah.
Right.
All right, let's move on to what's going on with the January 6th investigation and Steve Bannon.
Well, he has been found contempt of Congress. He's in contempt of it. Now, interesting on the vote, 9 House Republicans voted to find him in contempt. Now, it wasn't all of the ones who voted to impeach Trump. In fact, 2 of the members voted different, but 2 House Republicans who had voted against impeachment, which is Congressman Mace and Congressman Fitzpatrick, did turn and voted to, find Bannon in contempt.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't just down the line of those who voted to impeach found Bannon. In fact, 2 of them went the other way, Newhouse and Representative David Villalo of California. Voted against the referral. So very interesting to watch how it happened. I know Fitzpatrick. Actually, I campaigned for him before he ever got elected in parades up in Buck County, Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah.
And he's a pretty consistent guy, I would say, because if you're going to vote, about contempt, if somebody doesn't show up to a congressional hearing, you would tend to just vote against anyone that doesn't show up to a congressional hearing. And I think in his case and a couple others, that's what they did.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know Steve Bannon has contempt for Congress, but he's been found in right. contempt of Congress.
Right.
So what does that mean? Why is it important?
What it means is a couple of things. One, for Steve Bannon, his name is back in the media. He's going to raise money off of this, and he will, get his name back out there. In all reality, this will mean, in the end of the day, most likely it will mean nothing, because the way Congress has structured the contempts, they then go to the Justice Department. The Justice Department can take it to a grand jury. Then it goes to the District of Columbia into the legal system. And if you look back at history of these, basically it will go on for years. I think I'm safe in saying this issue with Steve Bannon could go 4 to 5 to 6 years, and then basically nobody ever really pays a criminal price in any of these. I mean, there's been a history of people that have been found in contempt. So, legally it becomes a battle that goes on for half a decade usually.
All right. For those Republicans who did vote to find him in contempt of Congress, do you think there will be backlash like there has been for those who the few who have voted to impeach President Trump?
I don't think so, Rick, because, again, if you want to have consistency, technically I think you could vote for anyone that doesn't show up for a congressional subpoena, because, they can show up and plead the fifth. Jack Abramoff did that, and I was never, subpoenaed into the Congress, but Jack Abramoff was in my case, and he just sat there and pled the fifth,
right.
over and over.
Right.
So that's what a lot of people will do. But I think, I think that there's a consistency, you could argue, that, look, anybody that doesn't show up for a subpoena, I'm going to vote to find them in contempt, because I dare anybody, I mean, any of your listeners, you, me, if we don't show up for a subpoena, guess what? It won't go through the D.C. process. They'll come get us.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, so. Too true.
Right.
All right. In the Senate, it's the Bernie and Joe show. What's going on with Bernie Sanders and Joe Manchin?
You know, knowing both of these senators, I served with Bernie, and I was a state senator way back when Senator Manchin was a state senator. We both chaired committees on opposite sides of West Virginia and Ohio, and I know their personalities. And I will tell you, I can just imagine this meeting because you know, Senator Manchin has clearly said he wants $1.5 trillion, and there's been a lot of pressure on him to do opposite. Now he's not only talking about money, but Senator Manchin has talked about the philosophy of things. He said he's not really willing to do now a child tax credit unless there's some work involved for parents that aren't working to get that, you know, that assistance for the daycare and things. So now he's kind of going, Senator Manchin is going philosophically. So he and Bernie Sanders met the other day, and Bernie, of course, would like to have $6 trillion, but you know, he's pared it down to $3.5 trillion. Mm-hmm. And when they met, Senator Manchin, and this leaked out, and I'm completely sure that he did say this, he turned to Bernie and said, look, I'm comfortable with zero, doing nothing, you know, he told him.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's real, real clear that they're not going to move Manchin.
Yeah.
And they don't have the votes. And if they move Manchin, they still have Senator Sinema from Arizona. So I think if the progressives want a win, they've got to realize it's $1.5 trillion. Then they got to take their best shot on what they want to put into that $1.5 trillion. Do they want to get all of the programs funding a little bit, or do they want certain programs funding more? And on the town hall, the president said that he's abandoning the corporate tax increase because he doesn't have the votes. So this is, Rick, in a nutshell, in layman's terms, there's a problem on this whole thing.
Well, let's talk about Senator Sinema from Arizona. She ran into a little bit of heat this week, lost some people from her Veterans Committee.
Yes. Now, which incident?
So didn't she have some people resign from a committee she has made up of veterans who aren't in agreement with what she's been holding out for on this situation?
Yes. In fact, I could be wrong, maybe five or six that were advising her, and they are saying that they want her to resign. They were on her advisory board, and they quit, and then they said that she was the principal obstacle to progress. They said that she refused to do something with the filibuster, and they talked about, you know, other issues, but they're affecting veterans, prescription drugs, you know,
mm-hmm.
and her opposition to parts of the reconciliation bill. Now, I think that probably when there's an advisory committee, and I used to do this too, this is kind of an ad hoc committee that the members of Congress form. Like, I would go in my district and say, you know, who would want to be on my Veterans Advisory Committee or my Economic Development Advisory Committee? And I think that's what she did. I don't think they had official paying jobs with the committee.
Right.
But they were her advisors, so they're saying that because she doesn't want this reconciliation bill, that, you know, she's an obstacle and they don't want to advise her anymore on veterans issues. So it's, you know, it's a hit, especially if they were from her district. And I don't know that they were, but I'm assuming they were.
Yeah. One more quick thing. China ramping up coal production, Bob.
Yes, you know, we talk about the climate change, mm-hmm. And part of the problem with the original Kyoto Treaty way back when was that, and that's why it had no votes in the Senate, or maybe one, if anything. But you know, everybody in the world was in the Kyoto Treaty except for China, Mexico, Brazil, India, if I remember correctly. And, you know, if you're going to clean up the world, the whole world has to clean up. And China has been going on and on about us and climate change. Well, they ordered the country's coal mines to produce as much coal as possible. Of course, we all know, and if you've been to Beijing, you look up, and it rivals what L.A. used to have,
mm-hmm.
you know, where the sun had to burn off a ring around it in L.A. years and years back. So, you know, they, when it comes to, you know, needing coal and their population, they may have curtailed it at one time and say they're interested in climate change, but they have taken the production all the way up as much as humanly possible.
Yeah. National correspondent Bob Ney. Hey, thanks once again for being on the program. Always great to get your insight,
Thank
Bob.
You, Rick.
All right, take care. There's always someone within an organization that everyone else speaks of in those hushed tones of reverence. The person the rest of the staff wishes they could be as good as. We're going to learn about one of those people next. Chelsea Edgar of 7 Days got to write about one of those people. You thought I was going to say it was you, Chelsea, didn't you? No. Chelsea, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Nice to be here.
I'm sorry. That was rude. All right. So tell us who Manon Belzile is.
So Manon is an engineer at Beta Technologies, which is an electric aviation startup headquartered at the Burlington International Airport. And basically what Manon does is build motors, and what she's trying to do is build the lightest and most powerful possible motor that can safely propel Beta's electric aircraft. There's all kinds of stuff that goes into that, but mostly what she's working on is, testing these designs to see the sorts of forces they can withstand to simulate sort of what might happen in the air, in the aircraft. It's a pretty wild job.
Well, what's her actual title, and what are some of the other names or titles that she's known as or known by?
Yes. So her actual title, according to the official company chart, is the Vice President of Propulsion. But Beta has that sort of startup culture. They don't really care so much about titles. They don't get hung up on that stuff. So she told me a story at her first year at Beta, at the company Christmas party. It was much smaller, and much newer then. It was launched in 2017. And everybody there kind of made up a title for themselves. And so the title that she made up at this Christmas party, which has since sort of stuck as a joke, was Vice President of Radness. And, she's also known as the Motor Ninja. Affectionately.
I love it. Tell us about her personality and what drives her.
Manon is an intense and competitive and driven person who also likes to have a lot of fun. Before she started working at Beta, she worked at Husky, the injection molding company, and she was sort of getting to the point where she was getting bored with work, and she decided that she wanted to just retire and become a ski bum. And so she assigned herself the task of skiing 150 days that winter season. It was 2018, which in Vermont, if you're a skier, is incredibly hard to do. Rarely are there 150 great days of snow. But she managed to ski 147. So she's quite committed. She wakes up at 4 a.m. most mornings without an alarm clock, and either goes into Beta to work on whatever complex engineering problem she's trying to solve that day, or she, in the wintertime, will maybe skin up smugs and get at least one run in before she goes to work. So she's super active and always likes to be moving.
I love it. So let's talk about Beta. What have they been able to accomplish so far?
So Beta so far has developed a prototype of a plane called a LEA, and it's a electric vertical and takeoff aircraft. So basically what it means is that it flies kind of like a drone, if you can picture that. A drone kind of rises into the air and then moves forward and then lands, kind of descends vertically as well. So they've built this plane. They've gotten a significant amount of investment. Just in this last year alone, they earned something like $368 million in investor funding from some pretty major companies, including Amazon's Climate Pledge Fund. They're up and running. They've got some deals with various other companies who have requested a number of planes. So the timeline they're working on is, they're a few years out from having that inventory of planes yet, but ideally they're looking to you know, kind of transform the way people and goods move around. So one of their customers is UPS. UPS has contracted them, I think, for 10 planes by 2024 for its shipment routes. So, you know, according to the founder, Kyle Clark, these will sort of become, you know, what he sees as the future of mobility for people and goods, you know, and part of that has to do with reducing greenhouse gas emissions from planes, which are, you know, huge consumers of fossil fuels.
How much further does Beta have to go before these are ready?
Well, I think that for a number of reasons, they keep a bit of a lid on exactly where things are in terms of the development of their projects. But, you know, they seem optimistic that in about 3 years, they'll have enough data for the FAA to certify ALIA for commercial use, which is sort of the next key hurdle that they need to clear in order to make good on these deals with UPS, for instance, and other companies. So that's the timeline they're roughly working towards.
And Chelsea, these wouldn't replace the big, like, cargo planes, would they? As you mentioned, they kind of are lighter, they're smaller, you know, they're electric driven. But how much can they really carry, you know, how much would they replace? How would they be used?
So that's a really good question. I think that, you know, their current capacity, carrying capacity now is about 7,000 pounds. So that's the equivalent of, you know, six passengers or three or four pallets of cargo.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly that's smaller than, you know, these massive airliners, but what they're thinking, I think, is that, you know, these will be so much more cost effective to operate. You know, it costs way more to, you know, have like an hour of airtime, on jet fuel than an electric, you know, electric, battery powered aircraft. And so I think what they're hoping long term is that that will pay off, you know, in terms of the, you know, the cost, the economy of doing it this way will be much cheaper and much more advantageous than relying on jet fuel powered planes.
All right. I want to get back to the VP of Radness, Manon Belzile. And why is she a fit at Beta Technologies where she might not have been at, you know, a more corporate setting?
I think Manon is a very independent minded person. And, you know, as I wrote in my story, there's a quote that's from her in the dry erase board in her office that says, I really don't want to be bothered with limits. And I think that kind of tells you a lot about her right there. She likes to be, you know, free to speak her mind and to try new things. And I think Beta really embraces that. And, you know, she's free to sort of, you know, do things as she sees fit. And there's a, you know, the culture there is very much employee driven. There's not this hierarchical management structure. You know, for instance, employees don't have to get clearance from their supervisors if they want to take vacation time. They check in with their teammates and say, hey, where does this project stand? Is it cool if I take some time off?
Hmm.
And so that kind of self-guided ethos works really well, I think, with Manon's personality.
Well, she also doesn't want to be bothered with shoes, I think you learned as well. Now, so you mentioned her desire to be a ski bum and get out there and ski at 4 a.m. in 150 days, but she's been in the Olympics.
Yes. Yeah, she was. She represented Canada in women's track cycling in the 88 Olympics. So she's a super competitive athlete as well, or, you know, has been in the past, and certainly keeps that up with, you know, the skiing. And she also is an avid rower when the lake is, you know, not frozen.
Mm-hmm. Lived on a sailboat for a while.
Yes. Lived on a sailboat for a while, raised two very small children on the sailboat, which I think is an absolutely incredible triumph. Lived and sailed this boat from, off the coast of Connecticut, the Long Island Sound, and then had it anchored off the coast of Los Angeles and San Francisco. So, she's had quite a varied, adventurous life.
Speaking of which, and we only have about a minute and a half left, but tell us just a little bit about the very scary encounter she had while studying in Montreal.
Sure. That's an important thing to know about Minot, is that where her grit and perseverance comes from. But she was she survived one of the worst shootings in Canadian history, in 1989, when she was a student at the engineering school in Montreal, an undergraduate student. A gunman came in and ended up shooting and killing 14 people, and she narrowly escaped, but which was, you know, just an unbelievably, an impossible thing to imagine. But, you know, she was, you know, she made it out alive, and pretty badass.
Yeah, at one point coming face to face with the gunman, running off, and him firing shots at her. It really has certainly imprinted itself on the Motor Ninja, the VP of Radness. What a woman, what an absolute competitor, and doer and creator. You can read Chelsea Edgar's story of Minot Bazile in this week's issue of 7 Days, or at 7daysvt.com. Chelsea, thanks so much for sharing her story. That was really a great profile.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Take care. We're going to take a break for news, and then we're going to do some more 7 Days stuff. We're going to hear about this weekend's Vermont Tech Jam. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table, and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest, and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping, and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Zingari. Something techy and wonderful is happening this weekend on the shores of Lake Champlain. And if you've got an ounce of technology in you, it's where you want to be tomorrow. Here to tell us all about it is the Vermont Tech Jam organizer, Kathy Resmer. Kathy, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. It's so nice to be here.
Oh, it's always great to have you. Kathy, what actually is a tech jam?
Yeah, good question. Well, so the Tech Jam is a tech career and tech expo, basically. So it's we originally thought of it in 2008, 7 days, and a coalition of public and private sector partners thought of it kind of as a job fair on steroids. I mean, the idea was really to, you know, we wanted to get all of these companies in Vermont who are doing technology-related things, but, you know, maybe their customers are not local. They're working with businesses around the globe, and so they're not really advertising to Vermonters. Vermonters may not even know their names, but they are operating here, and they're employing people here, and they have really good-paying jobs. So the idea was to get all of these really interesting companies together under one roof and, you know, let people see the kind of jobs that they can both, you know, apply for and train for, and, you know, combine that with some technology training programs so people can get a sense of what they want to do and figure out how they can make that a reality.
How has the tech sector here in Vermont changed from 2008 through now?
It feels to me like it's bigger. You know, I'm a humanities person myself.
I wondered if you were a techie or not.
Well, you know, it's funny. So I'm kind of an early adopter. I like to know what's coming and try to figure out what's next. So that's, you know, that's part of just my own DNA. But but in generally, I was an English major in college, and I got into this business because I was a writer 7 days. And ended up learning about the internet and how we could make that work with journalism. And so that's how I kind of ended up here. But, you know, it's been an interesting journey over the last, you know, 13 or so years. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
It's been a while. So we started in 2008. It's been really interesting to me to see companies start and grow and then, you know, either get sold to somebody or, they like dealer.com, you know, when we first started, Dealer was pretty small. And now it's huge and owned by Cox Automotive. Mm-hmm. Done through a couple of sales since then. And then there were companies, you know, companies like MyLab Grocer, which was really big for a while and was sold. Well, it turns out, and this is something that happens a lot, it turns out that guys, you know, Rich Tarrant and Jerry Tarrant, the guys who founded MyLab Grocer, they actually are exhibiting at this tech jam with a new company that was started by a guy who was in the leadership at MyLab Grocer, who came up with this new great idea, and they're coming to the tech jam to hire folks for that. So
that is great to hear.
Some of those same people just, you know, going on to create new companies and different, that do different things.
Why is this something, the tech jam, that 7 days has always been so invested in right from the start?
Well, you know, a lot is because, well, two reasons. One is because we were seeing in, you know, we have employment ads in 7 days, and we were seeing all of these companies exhibiting that, honestly, we've never heard of.
Right.
What do these guys do? You know, what's this about? And we were talking to those companies, and they're saying, well, you know, we have trouble finding workers. That's the biggest problem. We need to recruit more folks to these jobs and really to keep the young people who are graduating from Vermont colleges, mm-hmm. you know, keep them in Vermont and let them know that they can get a job right here. They don't have to go to Boston or New York or Silicon Valley. So there was that. There was just seeing the problem of our advertisers and figuring out, well, how can we help them solve that problem? But the, you know, the other thing was really realizing that there were all these stories that were out there that no one was really telling back in 2008. You know, people didn't, you know, when people think of Vermont, they think of, you know, maple syrup and skiing, typically.
Right.
You know, I think that has changed a bit over the years, but we were just seeing all of these folks, and, you know, because we're curious reporters, we are asking questions, and it was just really exciting to find out that some of the stuff is based here. Like this company, Green Sea Systems. Well, Green Sea.
Yeah.
Now, years ago, you know, I just saw that company on the list and called them up. I had no idea what they were doing. And they're building control systems for marine robots.
Incredible.
Like, they're doing all of this underwater exploration. And they're developing that software here in Richmond.
I know. I had them on a few months ago. I was stunned. You know, that was happening here in our state. Hey, well, Kathy, there are several sessions going on tomorrow. So take us through what happens at each.
Sure. Well, there's two sessions. So one of the things we did new this year, we've split the day up into two sessions to avoid crowding. You know, we're trying to minimize the crowd levels at the event.
Sure.
Because of the pandemic, obviously. So everyone's going to be wearing a mask. We've spread the event out into two buildings at Hula. So there's a big building right on the main road there, and then there's another one behind that where there's a couple companies exhibiting. And so people can come from 10 to 1 in the morning, and that's a free session, just like the Tech Jam has always been free. And we don't have, you know, we didn't schedule any panel discussions in small rooms where people have to sit for an hour. We got rid of that this year. And we've just encouraged people to move through the buildings and check out the exhibitors and really to look at the building. You know, one of the things that's happening this year is that we have this incredible venue.
Mm-hmm.
It's at Hula in Burlington. I don't know if folks know this. I was listening to the Tech Jam ad that we had on just before this segment. It's the former Blodgett Oven Factory. And Russ Scully bought it in 2017 and has turned it into this really building that looks like it's straight out of Silicon Valley, and it's like beautiful tech. He calls it a tech campus, basically in the Lakeside neighborhood there. And so you can go in and look at the building, walk through, and then see some of the companies that have offices there, like Benchmark Space Systems, which is developing propulsion systems for small satellites. You know, you can go visit their office. So you can do that from 10 to 1. Is a free session. But then in the afternoon, we split it up into these two sessions. In the afternoon from 1:30 to 3:30, that has an admission charge of $10, $15 on the day of the event, so tomorrow will be $15. And that also includes admission to the keynote presentation, which is going to happen from 4 to 5. And we've got, it's just, we've never had a keynote at Tech Jam before because we weren't sure, you know, who could we get that has a national reputation, but also Vermont connections and would be inspiring and relevant to Vermonters. And we got, this year we have Kyle Clark, who's the CEO of Beta Technologies, and their first customer, Martine Rothblatt, who is the CEO of United Therapeutics. And Beta, for people who don't know, is basically trying to invent electric aviation. Mm-hmm. So they're based at the Burlington Airport, and you can see all the construction that's underway on their headquarters as you drive to the airport. And they are building planes that are powered by electricity and batteries, and they're building a fleet of them and the charging stations that will go with them, so they're going to be able to fly, like, 250 miles, and they've got to get recharged at these charging stations. So Beta is building out this whole network and coming up with the technology. And they're, you know, it's being made right here in Vermont, which is really exciting. And Martine actually is just an incredible
visionary
individual.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know, you know, I hadn't made this connection yet. So United Therapeutics, you know, Martine, co-founded Sirius Satellite Radio.
Right.
She helped develop the technology that powers it. Her daughter was diagnosed with a fatal lung disease, and she took the money she got from the sale of Sirius, and she started a bioscience company to search for a cure for this disease. Well, they developed 5 FDA-approved medications to treat the disease, but the only cure is a lung transplant. And so, and as you may know, you know, 99% of people who need lung transplants will never get them because of the shortage of organs. So United Therapeutics is actually working to manufacture those organs, which sounds like crazy sci-fi stuff. But actually, just yesterday I was reading in the New York Times that one of United Therapeutics' subsidiaries, Revivicor, just successfully managed to connect a human to a kidney that was grown in a pig and is now and was able to function normally. It's kind of really crazy, mind-bending stuff, but yeah. They basically, you know, United Therapeutics is on this quest to find a way to have more organs for people you know, who need them. And Beta Technologies, it turns out, is part of that drive, that vision of Martine to create a network of electric-powered airplanes.
That really is
kind of crazy.
Yeah, it's a coup having Martine Rothblatt and Kyle Clark tomorrow there at Tech Jam. Kathy Resmer is the organizer of Vermont Tech Jam. It's going on tomorrow, beginning at 10. And to learn more, you can go to techjamvt.com. Kathy, thanks so much for being on with us this morning. Good luck tomorrow.
Thanks, Rick. Appreciate you having me.
All right. Take care. Okay. First of all, this one's from Amanda, and this had to do with prohibition. So if you remember, on Tuesday, I believe it was, Charlotte Strasser was in with me. She played a couple mystery cuts. She has been digging up a lot of great audio clips from our 90 years here on the air. And I think she's found stuff on, like, wax paper that she needed a stylus, you know, to play and record it, you know, put it into the system. She's probably had DATs and vinyl. And so this one was on vinyl. It was about an ad that sounded like it was a reaction for somebody who against maybe a reintroduction of prohibition is what it kind of sounded like. And Amanda wrote in, and she said, I was a reporter for the Times Argus for 7 years in the early 1970s. There was a very active Women's Christian Temperance Union, WCTU, group at the time in central Vermont. It was led by Lucy Chase of Plainfield. They held lots of meetings and submitted information to the paper almost every day. Just a guess, but maybe these women pressured someone in the Vermont legislature to begin a discussion on prohibition and the alcohol industry, and maybe wanted to thwart any further discussion. So, that's some great information about the Women's Christian Temperance Union. And if anybody knows any more about that or knew Lucy Chase of Plainfield and the work she was doing, would love to hear from you. We're still trying to piece together what exactly the ad we heard on vinyl that was pressed here up on Blush Hill at WDEV is all about. We're still not fully in the clear. We've gotten several things, as I mentioned, Corinne Cooper, who we had on earlier this morning, president of the Berlin Historical Society, had sent articles through the 50s, 52 through 58. They were in papers in Springfield and St. Albans that also at that time there was a group, pushing what seemed like a reintroduction of prohibition. So prohibition ended in, I guess, about 31, if I'm not mistaken. So this would have been decades later. But, what did we hear? Beer is something like the fluid of moderation, or it was a great term we heard. All right. So the other thing that we brought up this week, I heard from Monique, and she's in Williamstown, and she said, hey, through the years, there's been all kinds of great things that have been put up for sale or people looking for on the trading post on WDEV. And I said, look, if you remember anything that was kind of out of the ordinary, let us know. And I heard from Leighton. Leighton emailed this. I remember several years ago when the station did a retrospective on great moments on the trading post. My favorite was called in by a woman whose husband didn't come home the night before, and she made the announcement and then said whoever had him could keep him. I asked Ken Squire about this, but he doesn't seem to remember that. Maybe someone else there does, or maybe my memory is failing. It would be interesting to investigate. Not to be forgotten are the days when heifers were routinely sold through the trading post. We don't get many heifers, but we do get some pullets, a lot of free roosters. That gets us ringing the bell. Anytime there's something free, and roosters are always free. It looks like there's always a new home needed for extra roosters. We have some piglets for sale every once in a while, things like that. Oh, the beverage of moderation. Yeah, the beverage of moderation is what beer is, and that's what we heard on the piece that Charlotte played for us. So it was an interesting week, kind of a quirky week. And then it winds up with, here's Kaya. Oh, here comes Kaya. Here comes trouble. I knew I was not going to get out of this day.
Hey,
this week.
I'm the one that just sort of, listens and helps out when need to be.
The beverage of moderation.
Beverage of moderation. Trading Post, Cousin Harold did the, Harold Grout did the Trading Post a long, long time.
Yep.
And he was doing it when I, arrived in 82. A couple of things he had a Reggie Jackson. Is he a baseball player?
Yes, he is.
Reggie Jackson cookie card. He couldn't read the handwriting. It was a Reggie Jackson rookie card. But he announced it as a cookie card. And then there's also the one, haven't mentioned it, but it's where you put the emphasis on the words.
Oh, yeah, sure.
He had a black girl's bicycle, not a black girl's bicycle. Because I remember hearing that thinking, wow.
Yeah.
Women of color ride a different bike.
But that wasn't the case.
Okay, that was not the case.
It was the color of the bike.
Yes, it was a
black girl's
bicycle.
Yeah.
Those were two of my favorite.
Makes a lot of difference where you put the emphasis.
And then God bless Mike Carey. There were organisms in the water in Lake Champlain, and he said orgasms. But you say it with conviction, Rick.
You do.
And you just go right over it.
That's one thing we do learn in this industry, that when you screw up, you know, even when you think you might be wrong, say it with all the confidence in the world.
Enjoy the weekend.
It is so great that you stopped by. Those were some gems from the Trading Post history. All right, so we'll continue to collect those. If you remember anything quirky, funny, interesting, you know, out of the ordinary, we love hearing about them. The Trading Post has a long history and will indeed forevermore. As a matter of fact, a couple sessions of the Trading Post tomorrow morning here on WDEV. All right. I think we're going to have to put a bow on this entire week, although Brady Farkas and I will be back at noon, DJ Brady, for the midday news service. That's it for this slightly off-kilter week and our show for today, Vermont Viewpoint, directed by none other than Danny McGivrigan. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at WDEV.com. The WDEV podcast, sponsored by The Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. We've got Common Sense Radio coming up next with Bill Sayre. I'm Rick Singeri, and on Monday we'll hear from Hunger Free Vermont. We'll do a little baseball talk with author Christopher Thomas Green. We'll see, you know, if we're going to be happy about what's happened with the Red Sox or if we're going to be lamenting it. And we're also going to learn about the this is great for as we lead into Halloween, the Bowman Mansion in Cuttingsville, purportedly haunted. That's all coming up Monday. I'll meet you back here then.